is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and I welcome Colonel Jeff McCausland, United States Army retired, for CBS News, author of, most recently, Battle-Tested, Gettysburg Leadership, and I need leadership help now because there is not positive news coming out of Afghanistan. Jeff, a very good evening to you. The headlines are grim from London. I read The Guardian. Gunmen kill 10 mine clearance workers in Afghanistan. Attackers burst into Halo Trust Charities camp in Baghlan province, killing men in cold blood. What is Halo Trust, and what does this tell us about these last weeks of the U.S. military presence with our allies in Afghanistan, and what comes next? Good evening to you, Jeff.
John, good evening to you. Well, the Halo Trust actually was formed back in 1988, even prior to 2001. It has about 3,000 staff. It's a not-for-profit organization. What it's designed to do is clear unexploded ordnance, bombs, artillery shells, and the like, mines from previous conflicts in Afghanistan. And obviously, they were very busy even prior to our conflict in Afghanistan because of leftover ordnance, particularly from the Soviet occupation, which didn't end until the late 1980s. And that's what they have been doing. I had the opportunity to spend a day with them. A lot of people understand that a lot of ordnance does not explode upon impact, whether it's a bomb or an artillery shell. And those particular pieces of ordnance, as time goes on, they actually become more and more unstable and therefore more and more deadly. And there are countless incidents in Afghanistan, unfortunately, about youngsters or people that are trying to clear a field for agriculture or whatever, hitting one of these things, exploding, causing civilian loss of life. The attack you talked about, which was just an execution, literally, as they walked through an area where about 110 of the Halo people were sleeping after a hard day out there doing this, and summarily executed 10 of them on the spot without question. The unclear right now, of course, who is responsible. Initially, the government said it was the Taliban. The Taliban has come back and said, no, it was not us. And I think it's possible that it was not actually the Taliban, but probably was ISIS. And the reason for that is the killers, as they walked through, kept asking everybody, how many of you are Hazaras? How many of you are Hazaras? Why would that be interesting? Well, Hazaras are Shiites, and ISIS has focused its killing and assassination on the Shiite population. But what it suggests to us in the broader of this withdrawal is a couple of things. One, how enormously unstable this country remains, that conflict is fragmented not only between the Taliban and the government, but other groups. And thirdly, there might be some belief that these people have tacitly or actively cooperated with the U.S., and there's a concern that those who have supported the U.S., interpreters, logisticians, and the like, who are Afghans, may face retribution either from the Taliban or ISIS as the United States departs.
The statement from the Halo people is shock. And the puzzle here, Jeff, if Halo chooses to remain in Afghanistan after withdrawal of the U.S. and our allies, this would appear to put them at permanent risk, that whoever is behind this killing is going to continue. Is that a fair reading of this? Because it's so monstrous to have done it.
I think that's a fair reading. And, of course, there are a number of non-for-profit organizations that provide assistance to the Afghan population, which is a population in great distress brought about by the conflict. And some people believe the number of refugees, for example, in Afghanistan, may be up to one-third of the entire population, either internally or externally displaced by the conflict, which could be as high as 10 million. If, in fact, we see more and more fighting and instability, which seems very, very likely, that number of refugees will only go up. Obviously, that puts more stress on these not-for-profit organizations that provide them assistance, but also at the same time, unfortunately, because as we see here, perhaps places those groups, Halo, Doctors Without Borders, folks like that, in greater and greater danger.
Another headline that is warning hostage advocates concerned by U.S. pullout from Afghanistan. This is the Associated Press. Advocates for American-held hostages overseas are raising concerns that the U.S. military withdrawal will make it harder to bring home captives from the country. This is a complicated story and many moving parts, Jeff, but I recall vividly how hostage taking and ransom and threats were used in Iraq to destabilize the Baghdad government. Do we expect to see the same model in Kabul?
Absolutely. And part of this is also profit taking. A couple of the people we think Americans still held. One is a guy named Mark Frericks, who's a contractor, who's captured in 2020. And the other one, of course, is a guy named Paul Overby, a journalist who's been held since 2014 by the Haqqani Network. I know a colleague of mine, a journalist who was, in fact, captured by the Taliban, held for 6 months, and, of course, he was ransomed. So some of this is actually profit-taking and a concern, of course, by the Foley Foundation in particular, that organization named after James Foley, who was summarily executed as a journalist by ISIS in Syria, actually, in 2014. This is going to be much more difficult to gain intelligence about where these particular hostages might be held. More difficult, obviously, to conduct any kind of a rescue operation. If you don't have that particular intelligence, then obviously the U.S. not having a physical large-scale presence in Afghanistan reduces any leverage we might have, particularly with the Taliban, on how that we might negotiate for their release. The release of American hostages or allied hostages was not part and parcel of the negotiations between the Trump administrations and the Taliban prior to signing the agreement, which called for the U.S. withdrawal back in February 2020. And many people have complained that was a serious oversight in those particular negotiations. But it underscores, you know, that broader issue, which is not only for hostages, but in terms of making sure that we don't see terrorist groups try to use Afghanistan as a platform, the reduced possibility of gaining intelligence on what's going on in Afghanistan after withdrawal is something the Pentagon is really, really concerned about, as are all our intelligence gathering agencies.
These two incidents, the one, the attack on an NGO doing merciful work, and the other, the threat to hostages anywhere, no matter whether you're in uniform or not, suggest to me, Jeff, that evacuating those who've worked for the U.S. government is not going to be adequate to the scale of threat. In addition, Taliban, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, cutthroats, gangsters, is it going to matter, Jeff, to the population of Kabul? Who is knocking, who is crashing through the door? This looks like we're finding the early stages of anarchy.
Well, I'm afraid that might well be the case. You know, in interviews with Taliban leaders, they have been very adamant that their goal remains to create an Islamic Republic. And they do say, of course, that they want people to live in peace. But, of course, at the same time, they're going to impose Sharia law on the nation, much to the detriment, particularly of the female population. The concern about those who have supported the Americans is high. We've seen several hundred interpreters assassinated by the Taliban over the last couple of years. And even though the Taliban has recently said, well, we're going to treat them fairly as long as they show remorse, obviously, that's not consoling if you have been an interpreter or if you are the family of an interpreter. And finally, of course, this brings out a broader issue as well, and that is what is the future of the Afghan government and its ability to protect the population, particularly in large areas like Kabul? And that will be dependent on a couple other factors, and that is, one, what kind of financial and material support the U.S. government provides to the Afghan government once we've departed, and number two, how effectively can we provide what we're talking about, an over-horizon presence for counterterrorism operations and potentially air support? Absent those two things, the scenario you describe, John, I think is a lot more likely.
What we have is a countdown to the unknown, Jeff. My reading is that we've never done anything like this, withdrawn from a country and provided security from long range. It's a puzzle. What comes next? At this point, do you believe the Pentagon is still preparing? We have about 30 seconds. Still preparing, so we don't have the battle plan yet.
Totally still preparing. The particular question is how we do that over-horizon presence. Where does it emanate from? Desire was to use Pakistan. That seems now to be impossible. Pakistan is not interested.
Right.
Or maybe one of the Central Asian republics, because we used bases there at one time. Very unlikely to opposition by Mr. Putin. So we're probably going to have to depend on bases we have in the Gulf, which means for aircraft purposes or drone gathering intelligence, it's going to be a 9-hour flight round trip.
Right.
So it's going to be very difficult to do that.
Jeff McCausland for CBS News. Colonel Jeff McCausland, United States Army, retired. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.